Good morning. Yes, I'm back after a couple months of absence from these airwaves. I'm Paul Rowe, and this is Wednesday Talk Radio. It's good to be back here. And that was, of course, Neil Young and Crazy Horse from their 1990 release, Ragged Glory with Mother Earth. Yes, she is still our precious Mother Earth, notwithstanding everything that's going on to talk about. What's going on, which is extremely disturbing. I've got Dar Jamil on the phone, I believe, from his home up in the Olympic Peninsula. Good morning, Dar.
Good morning, Paul. Thanks for having me.
You're quite welcome. I really, really appreciate having you on. You are one of the few beacons who are willing to stare in the face of what's happening to our Mother Earth, from the cumulative effects of what industrialization has wrought over the centuries. Brief introduction, you have been a frontline war journalist from Iraq to Syria, Jordan, and Turkey and Lebanon. And since then, you've been focusing all or most of your attention on what's happening to, as I said, to our climate, our very resilient, yet very fragile and extremely complex climate system. Your new book, The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption, out this year on New Press, takes us on a trip to climate-disrupted communities across the globe, from the glaciers of Alaska, where you spent much, much time, to Miami, to the Amazon. You write for Truthout online magazine, from which we'll be talking about some of your relatively recent articles. And anyway, I just want to say, when I reached out to you a few days ago, and I really appreciate on such short notice you wanted to come on, I said that I'm really been feeling for quite a while at something of a loss as to how to continue to talk about what's happening in a meaningful and effective, if that's possible, way. And I said I hoped you would bring some equanimity to the subject, which I feel you're doing. So I thank you for that, for your courage in just continuing to look at this and being able to think and write and talk about it in the face of it.
Well, thanks, Paul. I think that this, I actually, you know, haven't been taking interviews really lately because I've been really needing to kind of go into somewhat of a cocoon to kind of deal with things myself. But I think the way that you posed the request and exactly how you just phrased it now about just let's talk about how we can try to find some equanimity in the face of what's happening, because this is kind of the edge now where I've been living since my book came out, where, and I think where all of us that are really paying attention to how dramatic this time is, just how deep the crisis is that we're in. There's no more future tense about any of this. We are in this now. Yes, it's going to intensify and worsen, but we need to accept the fact that we're locked into some serious, serious times now that are upon us. And so that brings up a lot of existential discussion and literally how are we going to be? And it's why me and a friend of mine are co-authoring a column for Truth Out Now called How Then Shall We Be, where every month we're looking at different topics associated with this and kind of diving deeper into this. So how then should we be if we're looking at the possible extinction of even our species? And I'm not saying that's a guarantee, but that's just to underscore the severity of the crisis that we're in.
And is that your co-author, Barbara Cecil?
Exactly.
Yeah, because I read that. I mean, one of the reasons I did phrase it that way and reached out to you is I read the article, What Would It Mean to Deeply Accept That We're in Planetary Crisis, which is all the way back from May, the end of May, and that's, it's good to hear that you're going to be continuing along those lines, and we'll talk about that. And but of course, you know this because you write about it also. Some of your other headlines are, eventually we'll all be climate refugees, and scientists are stunned by how rapidly ice is melting the Arctic. You know, you have to also keep pointing to what's happening. Otherwise, you know, you have to have the context, because a lot of people still don't really understand some of the basics, let alone the advanced stages that we're in. So, I mean, it's just, you know, we keep having to say that it's like, you know, is anything unprecedented anymore? Because it seems like we're only living in unprecedented, you know, it's now, you know, this heat dome, you know, people saw this these incredible records being set. I think it was 106 Fahrenheit in Paris. Was that like a week ago or something? Just I was just in Italy, and it was hot, but I didn't experience anything like that. But so yeah, that heat dome that was over Europe is now over the Arctic, and so the rapid acceleration of Arctic sea ice that was already happening, I mean, it's unknowable what's going to happen as we speak, and then in the next few weeks, right?
Well, it is, and I think, actually, I really like how you just phrased that it's unknowable. And, you know, and that's critical, because what we're witnessing and what I've outlined in my book is that real-time observations, i.e. reality, i.e. what's happening right in front of our faces, is now way ahead of the worst-case predictions from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, other scientific studies. The second a scientific study is now published, it's dated, because it takes so much time, and especially most of them, which are peer reviewed, you know, this takes, you know, several years is a quick pace to get a study out from when the last data has been collected, or even 2 years is extremely quick. And things are happening and unraveling so fast now. The example you just shared is a perfect illustration of that. That you know, we, science can't keep up, and that's why those of us following these developments closely, consistently you see reports with a title or a subtitle of, you know, scientists are alarmed, scientists are scratching their head, scientists are amazed. I mean, excuse me, you mentioned the Arctic, you know, the permafrost up there is thawing right now at rates that it wasn't projected to thaw out, worst case scenario, for 70 years from now. The Arctic sea ice was already at a record low extent in June, and then now exactly what you just said, this heat dome over the Arctic, wildfires, record-breaking wildfires across the Arctic. I mean, this is where we are. This is how fast things are unraveling. And I outlined so much of this in my book, and I had braced myself because of the experience of the book, of getting to go to many of these places, including the Arctic, you know, up to Utqiagvik, formerly known as Barrow in Alaska, to write about the permafrost and the methane crisis there, and go out into the field with scientists and see this firsthand. And then now the acceleration is just, it makes me nauseous, frankly. And, you know, it brings up all kinds of feelings like fear, anger at those responsible, frustration, despair, because, you know, and then those of us born into this world where here we are, most of us still use fossil fuels, at least to some extent. And then how do we untie that, right? That knot that we're living in. And so all of this together is, I think now, this is the edge where I want to have more discussion, you know, because this is what we as a species get to tease out, along with trying to still figure out what can we do and find a meaning in what we do, because the idea that we can change this, you know, is folly. We know that we're not going to stop it. Maybe best case scenario, we could mitigate it a little bit, which would basically do nothing more than buy us a little bit more time to adapt to this permanently changed planet, because these fantasies of geoengineering and whatnot are insane. I mean, it's basically the leftist version of denialism akin to the right's version of the rapture. I use that analogy deliberately because it's insane. The technology just simply doesn't exist to scale, to do geoengineering to mitigate on a level that would really even have any impact whatsoever. So that leaves us with accepting we are locked into living on an irrevocably changed planet. Things are happening at a pace so quickly that, you know, as civilization, which is certainly going to collapse, and, you know, that might sound extreme to some people, but even NASA released a report several years ago warning that it could happen within 40 years. And every few months, another report from another think tank comes out pointing in that direction. Of course, we have Jim Bendel's Deep Adaptation paper talking about the inevitable collapse of civilization. And, you know, this doesn't mean, you know, immediate death for everyone. It just means the systems and the extraction processes from the Earth and the global transport and all of this system that is really essentially what's responsible for this crisis, it can't continue. It's literally going to buckle under its own weight because of the climate crisis, because of this economic a fallacy that we're living in, and several other factors. And so we then now, as a species, how are we going to be and what are we going to do? And it literally puts us on the front lines of an existential crisis and an ontological crisis.
Yeah, it's a, you know, I think of it as a kind of a cosmic existential crisis in the, you know, the old sort of archaic sense of cosmos, meaning, you know, this world beyond just the Earth, but the, you know, the conscious world that we inhabit is being rocked. And I think obviously that's one of the reasons, perhaps the main reason, why there's still, you know, you mentioned denialism on the left and right. There's denialism, there's refusing to face reality, there's so many different at root psychological reactions. And, you know, one of them that I've sort of been wanting to talk about, and it just, you know, that's what I meant is, like, how do you talk about it? Because there's so many things that I want to talk about, but it's just that the feeling of just being hit in the gut and sort of the future being taken away from one is it makes it difficult. But what I guess I'll say it anyway is that just the, you know, the idea that this, the refusal of acknowledging how badly we've messed up, and, you know, that all the systems that we created that support us, that we think that we sort of project our future with, are the cause of this. I think there's just an inability to come to grips with that. Anyway, maybe.
Well, and that's
Yeah,
that's a great point for us to talk about, because it brings up, I mean, well, first of all, I talk about the reality of where we are, and I don't exaggerate. I'm just pointing to observational reality and then some of the more realistic projections about where things are heading. And I've been accused of being too doomy or a doomer, but, you know, in reality, much of what I've written actually has already been surpassed by observational evidence, i.e., I didn't go far enough in talking about how bad things already are and where they're going. But I think in general, I've been quite accurate, and I do this because exactly what you just said, we have to have an accurate map of reality, right? And the analogy that I use when I've given lectures for my book is that, you know, if you go plan a backcountry trip, do you not want the most accurate map possible to plan your route and then navigate with? Well, of course you do. You don't want an outdated map that's not going to include trail washouts or where there's been forest fires or a water source that no longer exists. You know, I mean, you want the most accurate, timely map available. And that's all I'm doing with these reports, so that we know, okay, this is the planet that we're living on now. So therefore, how am I going to live my life and what kind of decisions am I going to make? So does it make sense to start, you know, continue to base my life around how much money I'm going to make or working in some job that I hate, knowing that, you know, the collapse of Western civilization is essentially inevitable? And I'll say that confidently. The only question is when, not if, but when. Does it make sense to, you know, start pretending like everything, all these status quos that you just mentioned are going to continue, knowing that we're not going to have Arctic sea ice in a matter of just probably a few years from now, 10 maximum. And then what that does, the global weather patterns, where essentially everything that we're seeing now, it's going to take it to an entirely new level as far as shifting temperatures, shifting rainfall patterns, a disruption that's going to be at a level that we haven't seen yet, and what that does to infrastructure and our ability to sustain ourselves. I mean, these things are imminent. And so when we understand that, this is not Chicken Little stuff. This is based on observational reality that's already happening. And so therefore, what do I want to do? What does it make sense to do in my life? And so that's why I put this information out there, so that people can, I think, make some dramatic changes that are necessary. And that includes what we're going to do to try to protect what's left, because that brings us to that point of, okay, well, so much is locked in, we can't change it. So why do anything? And that puts us square up against the issue of hope. And I dive into this in the book, and I've been talking about it a lot when I've given my book things. And it's, we have this ontological question. So where do I find meaning? And how am I going to internally continue to do the right thing in the face of what's upon us? And then it does come down to morality, where, you know, we are morally obliged to still do everything we can possible for the Earth and for future generations of humans and all species, regardless of how dire things become. And when I really commit myself to that, then I find actually a new energy and passion that actually wasn't there before mm-hmm. I was aware of the scope of this crisis. So in fact, I've found even greater inspiration and no hopelessness whatsoever.
You know, this idea of acceptance versus resignation was something I flagged as something sort of a response to things I read of yours and what I wanted to talk about. And I guess hearing you talk, it has to do with, I guess, a sort of an active, you know, acceptance is sort of an active process as opposed to resignation, which is sort of a fatalistic, passive sort of process, and sort of engaging with it, you know, actively and you know, thinking about it, but probably, you know, you do a fair amount of thinking with others. And I guess writing is sort of a different kind of thing than just sort of stewing in your own juices. You're forced to sort of, you know, confront, you know, sort of dialectically, you know, with yourself. But anyway, I guess we already have a couple callers, so people already know the number, but since this is a call-in show, I should give the number. It's 503-231-8187. And hold off just a second. I just want to sort of flag where I want to go. Hopefully the callers will stay on the course that we've sort of set here, not deviate too much. But yeah, I want to get a little deeper into these you know, the psychic dimension, which is both, as we said, sort of the psychological factors affecting like our ability to look at what's actually happening, and also what it does to us. And you were talking you have a interview that for Real News you did with a Darna Noor earlier this month, where you talked about, I'm sure you've talked about this a lot, about having to, that you said you had to really go through the gamut of losing all your own hope and struggling with depression and going through the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross five stages of grief. And continue, I'd like to delve a little more into that, but we do have a couple callers, so let's go to our first caller, who's Sean. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. I really appreciate you guys talking about this. It helps just managing the trauma and the deep grief, the deep despair that goes along with it. The reason I'm calling, though, I was wondering if you might be willing to kind of play armchair psychologist with me a little bit and turn our analysis towards the denialists. So, like, I do my best to know the enemy, right? So, like, I listen to libertarian conservatives, religious conservatives. I devour everything I can get my hands on to try to understand the underlying psychology of these people. And what I've kind of boiled it down to is it's like a two-year-old mentality of, like, you can't tell me what to do. It's like, and if you try to tell me what to do, you're a control freak. So freedom and liberty are all tied up with this, like, two-year-old notion of, like, well, if I want to drive a Hummer that gets 5 miles to the gallon, that's my right. That's, you know, that's freedom and liberty to me. And who are you to tell me I can't do what I want to do? So maybe you guys could delve into the psychology, the underlying beliefs of the denialists, the people who, you know, want the anarchy of production, just more production for profit endlessly, and how they believe at their core that that is freedom and liberty. So I'll just stop there. Thanks, guys.
Well, thank you, Sean, and really excellent points, and a really thoughtful question. I really appreciate that. And there's two things come to mind. I mean, that's actually, that's a fascinating topic I think we could spend a lot of time on, but just there's two things that come to mind. And Paul, you mentioned Elizabeth Kubler-Ross five stages of grief, and of course the first stage is denial. And I've had to work through my own anger at people that Sean just described precisely of, you know, it's almost like they have this impulse to just make things worse, just because it is this infantilized reaction of you can't tell me what to do. And you literally see these giant trucks going down the road with these massive mufflers, and they punch it and it just pukes out black smoke. I think most of us have probably seen these, and, you know, that's on purpose. You know, that's not a normal design for a truck. These people are, that's a reaction of exactly as Sean just described. And yet there's the denial phase of you know, on the right, it's like, no, this isn't even happening. And when I really look at it, though, through the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross model, then I actually get a little bit of compassion for these people, because they're denying it for a reason. They're denying that you have to deny it because it's real. And they're terrified, because this is an absolutely terrifying prospect. And I had to go through that myself, the denial, and then the bargaining, and then the anger, and then the depression, and then finally the acceptance. And, you know, I still bounce around in the stages a little bit, but generally I'm in acceptance. But it's taken me several years to get to this point. And so, knowing how much work it took me personally to get to where I can spend at least the majority of my time in acceptance, then I look at these people, hey, they're just getting an inkling, you know, of what's going on. And essentially, since we are all animals, then all of us can know and feel in our bodies that we're in trouble, just like a deer in the woods knows when there's danger nearby. Just watch how it reacts. And there's these instincts that are in all of us. And I think these people are struggling with those instinctive alarm bells that are going off resoundingly, and they're having these insane reactions. And that's also made worse by the propaganda of the fossil fuel industry and the GOP and this insane administration that's you know, full on into overt authoritarianism at this point, that emboldens this lunatic response. And then the other point, and I'll be a little shorter on this one, is that another thing that helped me really understand this kind of denialism, because, you know, these lawmakers, for example, right? Yeah, sure, they're basically just puppets of the fossil fuel industry. We know who's paying their bills, the Koch brothers and others like them. That's all extremely well documented. And yet I understand that, you know, the majority of these people, they have families, they have children, they have grandchildren. So how could they possibly be making these insane policies and ramming this stuff through, more fracking, more drilling, more production, with kids? You know, don't they understand that their kids and grandkids are going to need a livable planet? And the thing that really helped me finally understand this is there's a great Native American scholar. He's passed away, but his name's Jack Forbes. And he has a book called Columbus and Other Cannibals. I would highly recommend reading it, because in the book he identifies what he calls Wetiko disease. And it's essentially a psychopathy, a psychological illness, where if you catch it, and it is catching, then you think it's okay to take another person's resources or their life. And it, when colonialism hit the U.S. and then spread like wildfire across the country, and we know about the genocide that's happened here deeply, that is a direct result and example of Wetiko. And so you look at these people, like picture Mitch McConnell, and or picture Trump, or picture Paul Ryan, you know, or any of these other lawmakers, past or present. Picture their faces in your mind. Now, does Wetiko help you understand this? Because this is an insane person. They're literally in some form of cannibalism of the planet, of other life forms, of so-called resources. And they think that that's perfectly okay. Because why? Because it's just business.
Indeed. Well, listen, we're already about halfway through. This is an intense subject to get into, and hopefully we'll have further opportunities. And I thought Tim was on the line. It looks like he's not anymore. We got a couple callers. I did want to say that, you know, we're getting into the, you know, these, as you said, kind of existential, or as I said, psychological factors, dimensions of the subject. But of course, it's well documented. What's going on, and in your book, The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. Of course, there's another book that just came out that I picked up as well, called The Ice at the End of the World, An Epic Journey into Greenland's Buried Past and Our Perilous Future, which also looks rather good. And there's just so many others and articles, which of course are still not really getting, of course, anywhere near the kind of attention they deserve because of everything you're saying. But I guess I just want to say that if anybody does have specific questions about what's going on, because we're probably not going to be talking that much specifically about, you know, the increased melting of the Greenland ice sheet, Antarctica, you talked about the Arctic wildfires, you know, the renewed horrible assault on the Amazon under the new fascistic Brazilian administration. It just goes on and on and on and on. But if anyone does have any questions, you know, more specifically about what's actually happening, please call up. But we have Camilo on the line. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Good morning. I think you just mentioned that people can ask questions about the state of reality. What are the facts? So you've made them very clear, and as you said, there's plenty of information. And you started out your conversation about how do we deal with these questions emotionally. And I think that what you've been talking about all along are the ethical and moral questions that this crisis raises for all of us. And what you haven't mentioned is that the really deepest, most significant factor that underlies the problem and how it's developed is spiritual. And that problem is that how we have become separated from the earth. Religions used to have a belief in a relationship to the earth and showed some respect in the way we treated it. And this is still maintained in indigenous spirituality. But I think that if we recognize this, then we have to change our perceptions, our attitudes, and our reactions. And I think that Buddhism is especially well developed and has a history of dealing with the problems of this nature, the fact of impermanence, the fact of looking at death as nothing to fear. I mean, we have to figure out what sort of attitudes we take into the experience that is inevitable, that, you know, everything is going to come to an end. And I believe that, you know, even Buddhists themselves are not always ready to accept this with regard to society and the earth. And I believe that there are many Buddhists who believe in the concept of Ecodharma, and there is a book, Ecodharma, by David Loy, that addresses many of the questions that you've asked today. And I just wanted to mention that this is a way for people to come to grips with the difficulties that you have outlined.
Thank you. A critically important point, and yeah, I think Paul would agree, we just haven't had time to get there yet, because, you know, we start diving into any of the different facets of this conversation and we could spend a whole hour on just one of them. But I actually bring that topic in the conclusion of my book, and I take the Native American spirituality angle on that, in by way of interviewing a Native American elder of Cherokee descent named Stan Rushworth, and bringing in some stories. And one of the stories that I bring into the book, which I'll share now, is about a spirit. It's a story from the Pitt River Nation. It was told to Stan by his elder, Daryl Babe Wilson, and then Stan shared it with me. And I knew that was, had to go into the end of the book. And the story is about a spirit force that lives in what the Pitt River Nation name for Mount Shasta is Akuyet. And there's a spirit, the spirit force that lives in there is a small but powerful spirit named Mismisa. And Mismisa is singing. And that singing is what keeps the earth seasons happening as they win and as they should. It keeps the earth the proper distance from the moon. Essentially, to cut to the chase, is it keeps everything in balance and in harmony. And that singing is contingent upon humans listening, and listening in the right way, comporting ourselves in our lives the right way, where we approach nature in the mountain with the right respect. And of course, this is all analogous and symbolic and not to be taken too literally, but I think it's a beautiful story, and it makes the point very clear that if, as long as we listen with the right respect and comport ourselves the right way as we go up the mountain and how we approach the mountain, then that singing continues and everything is kept in balance and in harmony. If we fail in that and we stop listening, then ultimately Mismisa will stop singing and everything will go out of balance and life on earth therein vulnerable to extinction. And that is precisely what has happened. And so I talk about the need for all of us, myself included, to get back to remembering how to listen and going back to wherever it is in nature that we go to listen to Mismisa. It doesn't obviously have to be on that specific mountain. It can be anywhere, wherever your place is to go. And I think when I say that, most people probably have a place that comes to mind pretty quickly. And we need to.
I would say that place could be meditation.
Absolutely. I sit every day, and as well as going out into nature, because that's what I love to do and where I hear that singing the most clearly. And there's, so whatever our way is to do that, go do that. And Buddhist philosophy is another perfect way of that. And so I bring that into the book. And I think also, you know, one thing, Carolyn Baker, who writes very, very articulately about everything that we're talking about here, she basically says, look, going into this crisis without some kind of spirituality is akin to like running into a fire wearing a paper outfit. We have to have some kind of a spiritual base. And you know, some people are afraid to talk about that. But, you know, we're at this point of the crisis where we don't have time to screw around. Yeah, you need some sort of a spiritual base or you will spin out.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Camilo. I thought we had I can't remember her name, a woman caller, but apparently they dropped out. Let's just go right to Boris, who's next on Stack. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. I wanted to say that it is ironically refreshing to hear a voice of reality like Dar's in the face of all of the cognitive dissonance and propaganda that we're marinated in right now. It's so stark, the contrast of his voice versus what we are so used to these days. But I have a specific question, and it deals with what I think is an underlying factor behind what we're facing. And I'm talking about these self-reinforcing feedback loops. I've heard that there is something like 26 of these self-reinforcing feedback loops already in place that are irreversible. And I wanted to know if Dar could expand on that and kind of enlighten us as to what the reality is there.
Yes, thank you. Good question. And I write about this in the book, and I've written many articles on that. So I just pause because I just understand that probably most of the listenership here is probably aware of them. But I, for those who aren't or just maybe vaguely so, the basics of a self-reinforcing feedback loop are the most famous and common example used is the retreating Arctic sea ice, the melting of the Arctic sea ice. And so it acts as a giant reflector, sending solar radiation and heat back into space. But as the atmosphere warms, that ice melts and exposes more of the blue ocean, which then also warms, which then causes the ice to melt more, which reflects less sunlight, which then, of course, causes the atmosphere is warming, continuing to warm, and then the ice melts and the water melts and the ice. So that's how that goes, you know. And Dr. Dan Fagree, a USGS scientist that I spent time with in Glacier National Park, was talking with me about them because they were his single biggest concern. When we talk about the climate crisis, it was these runaway feedback loops and the nonlinear changes they bring with them. And the way he put it, to boil it all the way down, he said, look, the more something happens, the more something happens. And that's essentially what a feedback loop is. Well, and he proposed, you know, the caller brought in the number 26. I've heard numbers far, far higher than that. You know, other examples would be, you know, when the atmosphere warms, we all know there's more wildfires now and they're hotter and they're bigger and they burn longer and they're happening more frequently. And the more that happens, then of course, the more forest is susceptible to wildfires. Other things like the permafrost warming up and then thawing, and then that's releasing CO2 from the carbon content within it up into the atmosphere, which warms the atmosphere, which thaws the permafrost, which releases more CO2. So you see where I'm going with this. There's dozens now of these feedback loops that are kicked in. And once they are, just like what we were talking about at the top of the hour, it's basically not possible to reverse them. And what Dr. Dan Fagree, who I mentioned, said, I asked him, well, what is the thing that gives you the most concern about this overall crisis? And he said, it's the feedback loops and the nonlinear exponential change that they bring with them, because oftentimes when they start feeding off of each other and this explosive, unpredictable, nonlinear change that's already baked into the system. That's what keeps him up at night, because he understands deeply how far along we already are, how many of those feedback loops are already in motion. And when we talk about nonlinear change, that's why, you know, we're talking about, we mentioned earlier that even the IPCC's worst case projections are being outpaced by reality. Look at their projections from back in 1990, and even some of the more recent reports. We're already observing changes on the planet that are already ahead of their worst case predictions, even including the Arctic sea ice and the rapidity of the melting there. And so that's an example that, you know, these are outpacing reality. They're nonlinear changes that even their worst case projections can't keep up with.
Yeah, it's as I said when I reached out to you, and we are obviously finding ways to talk about it, but you know, even what to call it, you know. So I call this the great unraveling. I mean, words balk before the rapidity of the changes. And this summer, just, it seems to be, you know, certainly attentive observers like yourself, Dar, and others, some of whom I've also interviewed over the last few years, have, you know, some of them being researchers who are actually on the, you know, the front lines of studying these dynamics. They've certainly seen these non-linear dynamics already start to kick in, but it feels to me like this summer there's something, I mean, there's been something different about each summer, but again, that's the nature of non-linear. But this summer really seems to be, things are kicking in. But anyway, looks like we got another caller. Per, go ahead, you're on the air.
Question is, how do we stop the Brazilian fascists from destroying the Amazon? Just the other day, there's a news story that some gold miners that attacked an Indian village and killed a bunch of Indian people. So how do we stop this? I don't know. Do we arm the Indians?
What do you mean, we? How are you proposing to arm the... I mean, I used to know people who actually had run guns to the Sandinistas, so, you know, there are such people, but do we know anybody? Are we capable of doing that? I mean, I'm still in, you know, one thing I wanted to talk about, and you're providing the opportunity, Per, is, you know, I was an Earth Firster, you know, back in the day in the 80s and 90s, and I, you know, it was an amazing heady time where we really felt like we were actually taking on the beast, and we actually, you know, it helped spawn the Rainforest Action Network, which we're actually, you know, working along with some of those Amazon tribes people. And I actually met some of those Amazon tribes people in those heady days of the late 80s, early 90s. For me, that was like my mini 1960s or 1910s or whatever. But anyway, I still feel, and you do too, Dar, you know, you talk about in your book, is one way to keep, you know, to keep kind of sane or to keep feeling like you're actually engaged is to, you know, not give up and to keep actually doing things. And, you know, if only just to not let them, you know, the whatever, the forces of evil completely have it, the field of battle all to themselves. But anyway, so yeah, whatever. I mean, do you have any specific ideas about, you know, the Brazilian administration is truly... is as grim, if not grimmer, than Trump.
It is, yeah. And I, you know, I see those because I have a whole chapter on the Amazon and had the privilege to get to go down there and spend time down in there with Dr. Thomas Lovejoy at one of his most famous study camp, and absolutely fell in love and had a deeply profound experience with that rainforest and watching that news report of them killing the indigenous person and going in. I mean, it sickens me, it enrages me, and it absolutely makes me feel like, I mean, I want to do something. And I'm very, very careful talking about all of this to not give any advice or suggestions to anyone other than just to go listen to Mies Misa, because I bring that up because I feel like, look, if we're truly going to work for the earth, and if we each go out and listen very, very closely in whichever way that we choose to listen, whether it's sitting or going out and just being in nature, whatever that is, because that's where I've gotten my my callings to go to Iraq, to go cover the BP oil spill, to do this book. And if each of us goes and listens, then we're going to each get our own message and calling directly from Earth. That's what I believe. And that's why I just encourage people to go listen and then follow what their calling is, whatever that may be.
Okay. Well, thanks.
Good answer.
Thanks, Per. Looks like we got, let's just go right to Tonaldi. We got about 14 minutes, well, 12 minutes left. So maybe we'll have time for a couple more callers. If you do really, really want to talk to Dar Jamil, who I've been talking with, I haven't reintroduced him. I will in a second. But since I've said that we've got another caller, Tonaldi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, Paul. Thanks for taking my call. Excuse me. I'm struck as you guys are talking, and thank you. It's a wonderful and needed discussion. But excuse me, I'm struck by the absence of women in the conversation. I think there was one woman referenced as an author, but there are no women call-ins. And this is not the purvey of just men, but the lack of women. So I'd like to know, what are women doing to be active in both acknowledging and trying to work with what we have? I would also draw in the necessity of spirituality in this. I think that's absolutely critical. And the third thing I would say about it is that, you know, since we have gotten into a patriarchal mode of life and living around the world, that's what's a lot of what's gotten us so out of balance. How do we bring back the balance of women? So I'll take my answer off the air, and thank you very much.
Well, I don't feel the need to be defensive about this or apologize for my gender or yours, Paul, I guess. And we can't control who calls in and who doesn't call in. So I'll put that out there. I have several female scientists in my book that if you read the book, you'll see that. Put that out there too. The one thing that comes to mind that in working with the indigenous elders now, as I've been doing since the book came out, and one thing that one of my teachers has been saying for a long time is that, and I imagine that the caller and probably so much of your audience is probably already aware of this, but I'll say it anyway, and that's that the patriarchy of the dominant system that is killing the planet right now is doing so because it's treating the earth the way it's treated women. And these issues are symbiotic. They're so deeply tied. And one of my elders, he's an Apache who lives down in southern New Mexico with he and his wife, and they're both medicine people. They've both talked about this at length and talked about, look, how we treat women is how we treat the earth. It's called Mother Earth for a reason. And until that changes, we're nowhere. And we have to start with that. And if you look at how the dominant system treats women, and this so-called administration is the perfect example of just an egregious example. And it's hard to look at, but it's actually very honest in that way because, you know, the dehumanization, the sexism, the misogyny, the bigotry, the just blatant disregard for anything like morality or respect or integrity. I mean, that's what's happening. And go ahead. Sorry.
We just happen to have two more women callers, so I figured I'd
great.
So let's give them the microphone. Go ahead, Helen. You're on the air.
Hi. He was just saying about the things about women. Well, wrote something for the newspaper yesterday, and I'm so mad about the dump out in the country, and I just couldn't help but say that it was an abusive relationship to the land. And I'm so glad that what he said today. But the other thing I want to say is There was an article in Oregonian, and it's about Oregon State went in and cut so many fir trees down, and one was 460 years old. And so I called Oregon State yesterday, like, what's going on? Well, it's a mess down there, and they've stopped cutting the trees. But my feeling that I told them is, it's like the idea of being Catholic, redemption, that what they need to do, Oregon State, where the people cut all those trees down, they need to go down to the Amazon. They can take a camera, but they need to they need to take care of penance to go see what's going on down there, so they get some sort of realization, rather than being at Oregon State and just not thinking about the trees. And I think it is the idea that so many people are not in touch with nature, but I think it also goes to the point where there's a lot of cesarean, the C-sections of people having babies, because you know, the old way was be in the farm and you're squatting and you're having that child, but now so many women are not fertile and they're having a hard time having a baby. Okay, that's it.
Okay. Well, thank you. Well, let's just go right to the next caller. Karen, you may have to be our last caller. We've only got about 5 minutes left. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Paul. I'm glad you're back.
Thank you.
I wanted to emphasize relationship because I think that's a gift that women tend to bring, and that as this collapse is occurring, that we need to be exquisitely sensitive to one another's needs, and to helping one another to get through this together. I love what was said about Buddhism, but that's the cultivation more of the individual's capacity. And I'm not denying that a sangha also exists, but I think we need to work on relationships and community building, alternative communities, so that we can help one another. And it takes a lot. We sort of have to restructure our superego, our consciences, so that we're in touch with our responsibility to the natural world, and we're in touch with one another in healthy, good, healing ways. And we have to curtail our ids and our egos. We have to tame our ids so that we aren't predators. I know that as a woman, I've had a lot of predatory behavior toward me, and also brutal, dominating behavior. So that's what I want to emphasize right now in the discussion, is we need to work on relationship. It's as important as understanding feedback loops. So that's my feedback. Thank you so much, Paul.
That was wonderful.
I love it. I love it too. I can't add a thing to it other than to say thank you and underline it.
Well, you know, there are other feedback loops. I used to, when I felt more like there was a future in which, you know, we were actually battling the social forces of evil that have created this mess, and, or, you know, evil, I don't like to talk about evil actually, but, you know, the legacy issues of racism and classism and capitalism that are trapping us in these vicious cycles. Anyway, I always felt that one of the key ideas was the idea of, you know, of other kinds of feedback mechanisms, good feedback mechanism, one of which is, you know, the kind of alternative community and, you know, movement building. And that I felt like, again, and, you know, the heyday of my activist career of Earth First was really true. I mean, it's remarkable that a few people doing things can actually have this snowball effect. And I don't want to dismiss that. It's a weird thing. It's kind of a hard thing to bring up at the very end of a conversation. But the idea of continuing to feel that it's possible for a good contagion to happen, not necessarily to beat back the forces that have been unleashed, but as you said, Dar, actually, that just came to mind, you know, that not to be attached to results. So to continue to do these things and build relationships, that's my reaction.
No, perfect. And it's actually a good way to wrap up the conversation, because it's the way, it's the only way that we together are going to be able to be together and sustain ourselves and one another simultaneously, and love each other and love the planet as we go deeper into this time. And I've tried doing the lone wolf thing, and I had to realize that's just another symptom, part of the sickness that's killing the planet, and that reconnection and with everyone and all species in the planet, this is the only way to stay sane right now, and you know, just to listen together and talk together.
KBOO
and
Community
together.
Radio.
It's what I'm trying to do where I live as well.
Uh-huh. Well, this has been really a remarkable conversation, a good one to come back on to KBOO. I'm Paul Rowland, the regular host of Wednesday Talk Radio. I have a number of other co-hosts. We're sort of developing somewhat of a collective around this as well. It's who knows where that's going to go. But again, you write for a Truth Out. Your most the article we were talking about most, I guess, was "What Would It Mean to Deeply Accept That We're in Planetary Crisis," which you co-wrote with Barbara Cecil. And again, you said you're going to be having a regular, I believe you said, monthly series with her on Truth Out, the internet magazine. Your book, relatively recent, is The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. Thank you so much. I guess if you want to say anything more, you got about a minute.
No, thank you, Paul. It was really great conversation and great questions. Called in, and really, you know, I found it really personally helpful as well to just keep articulating all this and kind of tease some of this out, because I keep learning and growing each time I talk about it, and hopefully it's been helpful to listeners and your great host, and I appreciate you having me on.
All right, and once again, I appreciate your coming at the last minute when you were sort of retreating from this sort of thing. Okay, thank you again so much, Dar Jamail. Appreciate it. This is KBOO Community Radio. Stay tuned for more great programming. Maybe we'll go out with a little more Mother Earth from Neil Young. Thanks.
Swear.